This continues Exodus from Egypt, The Hidden Agenda. This is tape 4 in the series. Now, you say, Foreman's off his rocker. How could that be? There's no space outside the expansion. There's no time outside the expansion. What does that mean? The only reason why you can't understand what that means is because you're inside. You're not outside. So your whole existence is within that realm. You have no words to explain anything beyond that realm. Well, that's because I am that which I am, right? To be I am that which I am means that the Creator lives in a different realm than the created. You can't describe a Creator if you're living inside the fishbowl. It's like fish inside a fishbowl, wondering what life is like outside the fishbowl, right? Fish cannot understand what life is like outside the fishbowl. You can intellectualize about it. You can say the words. But if you live in water, you don't understand what it's like to be in Wall Street or to be in anything like that. It is not within your realm of experience. So you can say words, but it doesn't mean anything. So we can talk about a realm beyond space and time, but it doesn't mean anything to us because we're not in it. In other words, it's almost like you're playing Monopoly, right? The creator of the Monopoly game does not have to pass go, right, every time he rolls the dice. Right? It is a created world. It is an environment which he's created, but the creator is outside of that environment. What both Yud-Heh and Vav-Heh and I am that which I am bespeak is the notion of God not just as power, not just as El Shaddai, a very powerful force, but as something qualitatively different than a powerful force. And that is the creator, that which is outside of it all, that which is only definable in terms of himself, because there is nothing within the created world that remotely explains that which it is to be a creator rather than the creative. Now, incidentally, there is a bit of a problem here. And the problem is that if it's really true that God is beyond space and time, that God is completely incomprehensible to a creature, because he is the creator and we live in a created world with a whole different environment, essentially, than God lives in, then there's something almost sad about that. And that is, how do I develop a relationship with this God? If God is beyond my comprehension, if I can't hope to comprehend him, if I can't hope to understand him, if I can't say anything about him, then how can I relate to him? And this, I would argue, really is the question of religion. Any religion has to deal with this question. How do you bridge the gulf between a transcendent God and a corporal man? If you have people who are flesh and blood and God is not flesh and blood and we can't understand him, then how do we deal with a God that we can't understand? How do we relate to a God that we can't understand? One way to deal with it is to try to say, no, that God is too hard to relate to, and to try to humanize God. And I think that's the way that Christianity deals with it. One of the advantages, so to speak, of having a religion where you say that God incarnates himself into human form is then I can relate to God. If God can take human form, then he can have emotions, he can have feelings, he can have a body, he's a person. That's one way of dealing with it. Judaism refuses to do that. Judaism says that God is God and we can't understand him. That's just the way it is. But I think that the verses themselves might point to another answer to that question. That is, if you look right after God says, I am that which I am, that I am indefinable, and that I am ultimately completely beyond your comprehension, God says something else to Moses too. He says, just tell them, Hashem Elokei Avosechem Shlachani Aleichem, that God, the God of your forefathers, sent me to you. Zesh mi la'olam v'zeh zichri l'dor dor. That's my name forever. And that is how I want to be remembered from generation to generation. I think what God is really saying there is the following, that we labor under the illusion that how could I possibly relate to this God that I can't understand? God is saying you don't have to understand me in order to relate to me. You can relate to me even though you don't understand me. I am incomprehensible. I am that which I am. But I am also the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. If you want to know how to relate to me, the answer is I had a relationship with your parents. I continue to relate to you the way I related to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We can talk to each other. I knew your dad. I knew your father. And that's our relationship. And we can continue that relationship. You don't need to understand me in order to have a relationship with me. Indeed, I would even go so far as to argue that the most interesting relationships that exist between any two beings, between people and between God, are between beings that that one of the beings doesn't understand the other. If you actually think about human relationships, any human relationship in a certain way is kind of like that. When you think about another person, when you think about yourself, is it really possible for any other person to really know you, to know your inner experiences? Ultimately, one of the very lonely things about being a human being, one of the truly very lonely things about being a human being, is the recognition that self called self, at the end of the day, my inner experience is my own, and there is nobody in the world who has direct access to that experience and knows it like I do. People think they have a certain experience, they read my face, they can see by my face that maybe I'm having an experience kind of like they're experiencing, and they can say if I experience sadness, if I experience happiness, that must be what he or she is feeling. But it's a guess. There's no key, no inner lock to be able to really allow somebody else to experience what I am, what I do. We vicariously do that. I think that's really what empathy is about. What feels so beautiful about empathy is that somebody's trying to get into my skin. Somebody's trying to say, I'm trying to feel what it is that you're feeling. That's a very beautiful thing, but ultimately, it's impossible for anyone to truly feel and to know what it means to be inside me and inside my body and what it's like. We try and reach out, but ultimately, all relationships are a trying to reach out to a being that I don't understand. How is it that I try to understand a being that I don't understand? If I can't understand the essence of another human being, how do I relate to them? I relate to them through their actions. I judge them by their actions, and I seek to understand them and to make inferences by their actions, by the way they behave toward me, by the way they behave towards others. I try and say, I have a glimpse of what that being might be like. With God, we also relate to God through his actions. He acts in certain ways. We can't make inferences about his inner state, so to speak, because of that. But we relate to him through his actions. That's what the Torah is, the record of God's interactions with us. So God says, I am incomprehensible. I can't be understood. I am that which I am. But we still can have a relationship. And that relationship has a great deal of mystery in it, because you will never really know who I am. But one of the things that makes relationships interesting is mystery. There's plenty of mystery in the relationship of man and God. And just because there's mystery in a relationship doesn't mean that the relationship can't happen. Again, the relationship becomes more interesting. A male can never really know what it means to be female. A female can never really know what it means to be male. And that's why they're drawn to each other. That the mystery of relating to another, relating to someone who is really other than me, who I can't really know, is part of what drives relationship. God is the ultimate other. I come from him. He is my maker, but he is ultimately beyond me and ultimately mysterious. And therein, perhaps, lies the tantalizing urge to come close and to try to know that which I can't know. In any case, how does all this fit with the Exodus? The theory that I would like to suggest to you tonight is the following. That God intended the Exodus to prove something. And what he intended it to prove, or what he intended it to demonstrate, was to be a historical demonstration of who he is. And what he says to Moses going in, he says, look, there's a couple things that you need to know about me before we can go any further. Right? Thing number one is that I am that which I am. If you want to know names, right, I am utterly indefinable. I am the creator, and you can't define me. And moreover, if you want to know before we can go any further in these plagues, you have to understand that until now, I have been known as Kal Shakai. I have not done anything which human beings have experienced, which has definitively shown that I am anything other than something very powerful. Remember that the societies of the time are polytheistic. Everybody believes in lots of gods. There are no real atheists at this time. That happens much later with the advent of the Greeks and Romans. Before the Greeks and Romans, there weren't a lot of atheists around. There were polytheists. There were beings that believed in lots of gods. There was the sun god and the moon god. Every god was a power. Every god had a certain realm that he was in charge of. There was nothing that God had done in anything with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He had spoken to them. He had performed a miracle here and there, but nothing that definitively proved that he was anything other than one of a pantheon of gods. Right? Maybe a very powerful god, but a god nonetheless. The Hebrews have their god. The Egyptians have their god. What he seems to be suggesting here is that what I am intending to demonstrate in the Exodus is that I am Yud He and Vav He. I am not just a god and a pantheon of gods. There's no such thing as a pantheon of gods. There is a creator, and there's one God, and he created everything, and it all comes from one being that lives outside of it all, and that is me. And that is what I'm going to demonstrate in the Exodus. What I'd like to suggest to you is that the Exodus was meant as a historical demonstration of the truth of monotheism and the truth of the fact that God was the creator of the universe. Let me try and show you how it is that I believe that that is so. What is the difference? Let's talk about the difference between polytheism and monotheism for a moment. What really is the difference between them? Is it just that some people worship many gods and some people worship one god? No. There's a qualitative difference between polytheism and monotheism. The type of worship is itself different. It means something different to worship one, the sun god or the moon god, and to worship the creator. What is different about it? How is monotheistic worship fundamentally different from polytheistic worship?
Each one is limited.
Okay, each being is limited. Okay, now how does that affect my relationship with those beings? Let's say there is no creator, but there's lots of powers around. Okay, that's one theological view. The other theological view is no, there is one God and he's the creator. Right? Now, what is the difference between the worship of one society and the worship of another society? Yes?
Depending on what I want.
Okay, good. In a polytheistic society, worship is fundamentally based upon self-interest, right? In other words, if I see that there's lots of gods here, there's a sun god, there's a moon god, there's a rain god, there's a fish god, so what makes you decide which god you're going to worship? Right? Who you need at the time, or where your geography makes you, in a way that you want to create certain alliances. So, for example, the Philistines who lived in the coastal plains, right, their god was Dagon, right, which is the fish god, right, because they were a seafaring nation. They need to make sure that was their maritime kind of commerce, right? And if you were in Egypt, you had certain gods. Egypt was a very polytheistic society. They had lots of gods all together. Everybody had their god, okay? So one thing is that worship is based upon self-interest. Now, let's talk about monotheistic worship. How is monotheistic worship potentially different than polytheistic worship as something that's not based upon self-interest? What else could monotheistic worship be based upon other than self-interest? Why do we worship God? Is it because we want to get things from him? Well, that's one reason, maybe, but hopefully it goes beyond that. Right? What's the other motivation?
Appreciation.
Okay. If you're speaking to... No, let's try and bring it down a notch. Why would you be nice to your parents? One reason might be because you would like them to give you some allowance. Okay? But hopefully we would want our kids to be nice to us for more reasons than just because we would like some allowance. Why would we ultimately like our kids to be nice to us?
It's the right thing to do.
But why is it the right thing to do? Right. It's the right thing to do because we gave them life. Because there is something inherent about our relationship with our kids that makes the child ultimately in the debt of the parents. His life comes from the parents. His sustenance comes from the parents. And that defines the relationship. And therefore, it is just right. There is a moral aspect of a parent relating, of a child relating to a parent with derech eretz, with civility, with respect, right? Because we understand, we intuitively understand that moral component of the relationship that comes as a function of the parent having created the child. That's just the way it is. If you look on the Rambam, for example, in Hilchos Kibud Av V'Em, in the laws of honoring your father and mother, you'll find that the Rambam, in the beginning of those laws, goes out of his way to compare the honor that we give to parents to the honor that we give to God. Because fundamentally, they're based upon the same thing. Right? They're based upon the notion of creatorship. It's nothing metaphysical and so fancy why it is that we worship God. You don't need to be a great philosopher to figure it out. There have been books written about it, but it's really very intuitive. It's the same reason that we feel gratitude to our parents. We feel gratitude to God. That's why the Rambam ultimately says that's what it is. And the Rambam says that if you curse your parents, it's like you've cursed God. Right? And if you honor your parents, God feels honored. Right? That explains the Medrash, for example, and the Medrash to the Medrash says that when God gave the first two commandments of the Ten Commandments, all of the idolaters of the world scoffed, right? And they said, ha, God says, right, I am the God who delivered you out of Egypt, right? I'm the only God, and lo yelecha elohim achirim al panah, you should have no other gods but me, right? And everyone said, ha, You know, that's easy for God to say, you know, he's just egotistical. You know, he just doesn't want to recognize anybody else. But when the idolaters got to the last of the Ten Commandments, actually the fifth of the Ten Commandments, which is honor your father and mother, then they agreed even to the first one, which is I am the Lord your God. What did they see in honor your father that made them agree even to the first one and that there should be no idols? What they saw was that God was not egotistical. In other words, if God was willing to recognize the existence of creators other than himself, and was willing to recognize the creators other than himself were due respect, just as he was due respect, then you can't just say God was too egotistical to recognize anybody but him. So therefore, if he rejected idolatry, it must be because they aren't creators, because you see, God gives due to other creators. Okay, so the difference between polytheistic worship and monotheistic worship is that if there is no creator, and all there are a lot of different powers, then ultimately I have no moral obligation to worship any of those powers. The only possibility for worship is self-interest. Okay? I'm trying to get something from this power, so I give the power something. Whereas with God, there is another possibility for worship. The worship goes beyond just trying to get something from God, but is an expression of the unique relationship that I have with him as being a created being in relationship with the Creator, and there is a moral element. Let me ask you another question. Is there any such thing as sinning against a polytheistic God? I think no. I think you can get a polytheistic God angry. Yes. You can do something that makes a polytheistic God really mad. You can step on his toes. You can call him names. But if I don't have any fundamental obligation to worship him, and it's just a matter of self-interest, so there's no such thing as sinning to that God if I decide not to worship him. I just decide not to worship him. Right? But if I have a creator, and I say I don't want to relate to my creator, I'm cutting you out of my life, that's fundamentally a sin. What is the definition of sin? Sin has strong moral connotations. If morality is not part of our relationship in the first place, there's no such thing as sin. Sin, as we understand it in a monotheistic world, is actually a foreign word in a polytheistic world. Okay? You now begin to see the significance of Pharaoh saying, I sinned, right? That word is a word which doesn't really exist as such in the polytheistic dictionary. So one of the differences between polytheistic worship and monotheistic worship is that monotheistic worship admits for the possibility of morality, right? That would express itself in another thing. Let's talk about this. What motivation would I have to sacrifice or to offer offerings in a monotheistic world, and what kind of reason might I have for offering offerings in a polytheistic world? Let's start with polytheism. Why might I offer offerings in a polytheistic world? To appease the gods, right? So how come I can appease the gods? What? Or to bribe them, all the same, right? Appeasement and bribery is basically the same thing, just two different words, right? For the same idea. Now, why is it that I can bribe the gods? There's something about a polytheistic god that makes them subject to bribery. What is that?
They have needs.
Right. They have needs. If you look at Greek mythology or any polytheistic system, all the gods are like really powerful people. But they're human, so to speak. They have their frailties. They have their weak points. Well, if somebody has a weak point, it means I can give them something. They have needs. They have weaknesses. So I can give them things. So basically, what offerings are in a polytheistic world is a sophisticated notion of barter. It's just sort of metaphysical barter. What you do is the god needs something and I need something. The god can give me fish, right? But he's only the fish god. That doesn't mean he has grain, right? If I offer him grain, or I offer him this, or I offer him that, or I give him all the gold when I die, so then maybe the god has something and we have a little barter going on. How do you know that that is not a motivation for monotheistic worship? Because God already has it all. What do you give the person for Hanukkah that has everything? Right? There's nothing you can give him, right? Pet rock. So therefore, the motivation cannot be barter. The motivation cannot be barter. So what is the motivation? If God already has everything, why would I offer him an offering? Am I dull? Do I think that I'm going to give him something he doesn't already have? Why am I doing it? What's the reason? What is God getting from it? If God is not getting the rice and he's not getting the gold, what is he getting? What?
The gratitude.
He's getting gratitude, right? Even a perfect being, so to speak, appreciates gratitude, right? And that is what you're doing. In other words, when you give your parents also, I mean, we could take this down to earth in a very real way, right? When you give your parents something, right, again, there's two reasons you can be giving your parents something, right? So you have the medical student that the parents just put them all the way through college and they got married and they're coming to visit them for the first Thanksgiving, right? So they bring their parents roses, right? So the roses could mean one of two things, right? Right? One thing the roses can mean is, let's keep it coming, folks. I really need another 2 years of residency, and we have to remain on good terms. Right? All right. 5 years of residency, whatever it is. Right? So that is one thing the roses can mean. Now, if the parent realizes that the roses mean that, it is not good for the relationship, right? This does not help things, okay? But it's possible, and hopefully, the parent would hope that the roses mean something else. What does the parent hope that the roses mean?
Right.
Gratitude and appreciation. That's what you want out of roses. That's, by the way, I believe that once you understand this, you understand what was wrong in the story with Cain, of Cain's offering, that there is something abhorrent about an offering that bespeaks, keep it coming, right? You feel used in that sort of situation. So you feel very upset to get that kind of offering from beings that you've created. However, an offering that comes out of an expression of appreciation, comes as an expression of overflowing. The child knows that the parent can get roses if he wants. The parent doesn't need your $59 to go out and buy roses in a vase. The child knows that. So why do you give roses if the parent could buy themselves roses? Because I have to express gratitude to you. I express gratitude by buying you something really nice on my level. I know that you can buy this to yourself, but that's not the point. This is I must give you something for myself, and something that I feel is good for myself, because otherwise I have no way of expressing gratitude. That is the desire in the monotheistic system for offerings, but not in the polytheistic system. Once you understand this, you now understand the difference between speech number one and speech number two that Moses makes to Pharaoh, which we discussed last week. What I'd like to do is turn back to speech number one and speech number two, and to read through these speeches again. We were very confused, because when we looked at speech number one and speech number two, Moses starts off on a very strong footing. Pharaoh rejects him out of hand, and then Moses seems to retreat, and rather than up the ante and to force Pharaoh into a position where Pharaoh has to give in, and rather than just go back to God and said, well, I tried, you know, what should I do next? Instead, Moses seems to make this very weak kind of plea. I asked you last week to see if you could identify the differences between speech number one and speech number two, and we took a look at that. I'd like to look at that again. You actually came up with some good things. I didn't write them all down, so remind me if I'm missing some of them. But this is in the beginning of chapter 5, okay? Let's read it again. This is in chapter 5, verse number 1. Okay, I'm going to read it. V'achar bo'u Moshe v'aron v'yomru al paro. So this is speech number 1. They say, Ko amar Hashem, thus says Hashem. Now notice that the name of God that's being used, what name of God is being used? Yud He and Vav He. This name does not appear in speech number 2, only in speech number 1. So what kind of God is Moses introducing Pharaoh to right now? He is introducing him to Yud He and Vav He. Folks, what's that a code word for? The Creator God, okay? So Pharaoh, I would like to introduce somebody to you. His name is Mr. Outside of Space and Time God, the kind that you can't grasp and you can't understand anything about, because he's the creator of us all. And by the way, he is Elohei Yisrael, the God of Israel. Contrast that to the second speech. What does he refer to in the second speech? Elohei HaIvrim. What's the difference between referring to the Jews as Ivrim and referring to the Jews as Yisrael? Ivrim is just the tribal name, the Hebrews, the people that happen to be on the other side of the river. Yisrael refers to what? When did we get the name Yisrael? From Yaakov, from this special relationship that God has with Jacob, that he names him because you struggled with God. So this is a very personal relationship with God. So there's this very special God, he's called a creator, and he created a very special relationship with us, the Jewish people, and he is our God, and we're known as Yisrael. And got something to tell you about this God. He wants to say, Shalach et ami, send forth my people, v'yachogu li bamidbar, and let them celebrate before me in the desert. Contrast that to second speech. What's that in the second speech? Sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Is there any mention of sacrifice here? No. There's a notion of celebration. Okay? Now imagine that you are a polytheistic Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh, not only is Pharaoh a believer in polytheism, Pharaoh is the ultimate believer in polytheism because he is one of those gods, right? He is one of those gods in the pantheon of gods. So Pharaoh is not only a believer in polytheism, but he's got a lot emotionally wrapped up in this. Everybody thinks that he's Mr. God, and he thinks that he's Mr. God, too. So all of a sudden, you come to Pharaoh, and you say, Pharaoh, I want to introduce you to somebody. He's called the Creator, right? And he's got this special relationship with the Jewish people, and he wants us to celebrate before him in the desert. Why would Pharaoh not understand what you're talking about? Right? Look at Pharaoh's response. Pharaoh says, you must be out of your box. I have never heard of anybody by the name of Yud-Heh and Vav-Heh. There's no such thing, right? He says, Mi Hashem, who is Yud-Heh and Vav-Heh? Asher Ashma B'kol L'Shalach Zoh. Lo Yadati Et Hashem. I don't know anything by that Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh kind of name. That is very strange. And in any way, I'm not sending forth the Jews. Think about how foreign this is. Celebration before God, not sacrifice in order to appease the gods. That's what it's in a polytheistic system. But no. We want to celebrate before God because we just feel like rejoicing, right, in God and his bounty. There's no such thing. You don't rejoice with polytheistic gods. You barter with polytheistic gods. This is completely beyond Pharaoh's theological lexicon. So Pharaoh looks at this and says, you know, we are speaking two different languages. I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know anyone by the name of God. I've never heard of anyone by the name of this God. And I'm looking him up here in my little sheet here, just in case you're referring to one of those pantheon. I see nobody by this name. He's not on our list. Please go back. You can file an application in the God's department, you know, in the polytheistic God pantheon ministry. But I have no idea what you're talking about. And anyway, I'm not sending forth the Jews. Okay. Then, what is Moses? Now understand what Moses is doing in the second speech. What's Moshe doing in the second speech? Listen to speech number two now. All right. Vayomru. And they said, Elohei ha'ivrim nikra eleinu. No mention of Yud-Heh and Vav-Heh. Okay, verse 3. The God of the Hebrews. Which kind of God? The El kind of God. What does El mean? Power. The power of the Hebrews. Nikra eleinu. Remember Nikra? Nikra happened upon us. He didn't call to us. Right, like a personal kind of creator God actually interested in cultivating a relationship with people would call to you. Rather, he's just sort of happened to us, right? Because, I mean, you understand divine beings that just happen to make communication in a non-personal way with people. That happens all the time. Nelchana, please let us go 3 days in the desert. V'nizbuchan will sacrifice to this God of ours, which we name Hashem. Pen yifka'inu badever abacherev, lest he strike us down and smite us with pestilence or with sword. Pharaoh says, now you're talking. Right? This is the kind of God I understand. This vindictive kind of polytheistic God that you better make sure to serve, otherwise he's going to zap you with some lightning bolts. Everybody's got their L. Everybody's got their power. We've got our powers. You've got your powers. And that's what Moshe is saying. Moshe is saying, look, what is Moshe saying over here? Moshe is saying the following. Pharaoh, look, I told you how it is in real life. How it is in real life is that there is a creator in the world. And it isn't going to make any sense to you, but there's a creator in the world, and he wants us, and he wants his special people to go free and to celebrate him before him in the desert. I know, Pharaoh, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but just trust me, right? Pharaoh says, you're right, I have no idea what you're talking about, get out of here, right? So what does Moses say? Moses says, okay, let me speak to you, like you said last week, let me speak to you in terms you can understand, right? Let's start, as Julie Andrews says, let's start from the very beginning, a very good place to start, right? You can understand, right? You can understand that there is a power. Everybody has their power. There's the power of the Hebrews. So let's say the Jews aren't so special, but they've got a power. Everybody's got a power. At least let them go for 3 days and to sacrifice. I mean, look, their God's going to hit them over the head. They'll zap them with lightning bolts. You know, you believe in religious tolerance, Pharaoh. You believe in egalitarianism. Everybody's got their own God. We've got our God. We're afraid we'll get hit. Now, you'll notice that what's Pharaoh's objection to this? Does Pharaoh have any theological objection to speech number two? Absolutely not. He completely understands. He doesn't come back and say, I just told you I never heard anybody by the name of God. He doesn't say that. He has no problem with this speech. He thinks this makes a lot of sense. What is his objection? What does Pharaoh say now? Pharaoh says, oh, so I understand. We're talking about a regular power, the kind of power that if you don't go and serve, you worry about them messing with you. Well, you know what? It must be that you guys aren't working hard enough. Because if I made things sufficiently difficult for you, you wouldn't have enough time on your hands to go worried about that power. You'd be so worried about me. Right? In other words, if we're not talking about some transcendent God that there's some moral obligation to worship, but we're simply talking about self-interest, well, I can weight the scales of self-interest also. If I make life sufficiently hard for you, then you will worry enough about dying at my hands and about filling my quotas that you'll forget about these vague quotas from some divine power that you think, right? And that is exactly what Pharaoh says. And if you look at Pharaoh, that's what he says. Loma Moshe Varon Tafriu Et Ha'am. You know, I've got a lot of GNP at stake here with my slaves. Let them just go back to their work. And look at all these people, you're making them not work anymore. And he told them, don't give them any more straw, like you did yesterday. Tichbad ha'avoda al anashim, zavkin yirpim heim, they're lazy. Al kin heim tzavkim leimor nalchanuz b'chal aleinu. That's why they're saying, let's go sacrifice their God. They got too much time on their hands that they're worried about divine beings messing with them. Well, let them worry with an earthly being messing with them. If I double their workload, then let's see what they do. And that's what happened, and the people and the taskmasters strike them and say, Nirpim, verse 17, Vayomer Nirpim Atem, Nirpim. And the taskmaster says, you're lazy, you're just lazy. Al ken atem amru nezle nachaz nizbechal Hashem. That's why you're saying, go serve your God. So what happened is it backfired. But you can understand the logic here. What's happened is that Moses has introduced the parameters of the struggle. And the parameters of the struggle are, he said it like it is, there's a creator God, and ultimately this is going to demonstrate there's a creator God, but let's start with something that you understand. Now, that sets the stage. I'm really running short on time, so I'm not going to take points now. You can catch me afterwards, okay? This sets the stage for understanding the 10 plagues, okay? Let's look at the 10 plagues. One of the questions we asked is, why do we need 10 plagues? Right? Couldn't, if God just wanted to get the Jews free, couldn't he have done it more quickly and efficiently? Couldn't he have just frozen the Egyptians in place and gotten the Jews out? Why did he need 10 plagues? Okay? Now, if you think about it for a moment, let's play the following game. It's actually rather interesting. Let's think for a moment. You ever seen these computer simulation games like Civilization or Age of Empires where you get to play God, right? And you get to make your own civilization. Okay, so let's imagine we're playing one of these games. You are God, okay? And here is your goal. You have these inhabitants, right? You have this people that is enslaved, and your goal is to try to demonstrate the truth of your existence. You want to demonstrate to humanity for once and for all that all this polytheism is nonsense, because you realize that it's not really so fair to expect humanity to worship you if they can't really prove that you're there. I mean, nobody was around for the creation of the universe or anything, so it's not really so fair to expect people to worship you if they can't even identify you. So you really do have a moral obligation to let people know that they do have a parent, right? So you are trying to communicate this message now to humanity on the geopolitical scale to create an event in actual human history witnessed by millions of people that will stand as the greatest test and truth of your existence as creator. Now remember, this is a tricky task because it is not enough for you to demonstrate that you're powerful. That is not enough. You must demonstrate that you are the creator of the universe. How are you going to do that? That is a very tricky thing to do. So I throw this out to you. What would you do?
Outside the laws of nature.
Okay. You might go outside the laws of nature. You're not going to do it. Because any provincial god could also go outside the laws of nature. For example, let's say the sea god. Right? The sea god, if he wanted to, could bring a very, very large tidal wave that no one has ever seen before. So if you bring tidal waves, will this prove that you are the creator? No. Everyone's going to say, the sea god... So you're like tearing your hair out. You're thinking, here I am, I'm trying to get the message across, I'm pulling up, right? What am I going to do? What I need to do is I need 10 plagues, okay? Why? Because...
Each of them in charge of...
All the gods.
Right. I have to show that I'm not a provincial god in charge of a localized force. I have to show that I'm in charge of everything, right? In other words, let's say I have a, could I do it by a grand tidal wave? No, people would say it's the sea god. Could I do it by an earthquake? No, they'd say it's the earth god. Could I do it by you know, hail? No, they'd say it's the rain god. So no matter what I do, it wouldn't work. But let's say first I make the river into blood, right? And then everyone says, oh, you know, the Nile god got mad, right? But then next, all of a sudden, there's frogs all over the place. So what do people say? People say, ah, well, all right. So the Nile god evidently got really mad and made an alliance with the, you know, insect god, you know, in charge of frogs, and he's gotten him on his side, and they're really mad at us together, right? But then shortly afterwards, you've got lice, and just on the heels of that, you've got boils, and then you've got darkness. Pretty soon, the polytheistic mind begins to wonder whether it's really plausible that all of these alliances, I mean, this is a huge alliance of gods here. You know, people, gods don't usually get together in this kind of array. We're generally fighting amongst of one another. We wouldn't expect this broad alliance. So if you can show gradually, the simplest explanation becomes creator, one god in charge of all of these forces, instead of many gods, each in charge of particular forces. Interestingly, if you read books on the history of science, and particularly books like Tom Kuhn, and the book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, one of his interesting theories about the history of science is that you can't destroy a paradigm for viewing the world by asking one irrefutable question upon it. Because as we say in Yiddish, starb nicht from Akasha, you don't die from a question. Right? You have a question, you have a question. Eventually science will figure it out. In the history of science, and this is something people make mistakes about, it's not like you can find one great question. If your theory of the Big Bang is right, then how do you explain so and so? Even if it's irrefutable, no one will be bothered by that. They'll say, we don't know yet. You don't die from a question. Why? Because there's so many things supporting the paradigm of the Big Bang that just because you pull one thing out, it doesn't destroy the paradigm. It's like there's certain proofs, and these are the very strong proofs in the world, and scientific paradigms are built like this. They're like building baseballs. David Sadransky gives that explanation. He's used that in trials, right? That he told me a story that actually he's one of the top oncologists in the country, and he goes to anti-tobacco trials around the country, and he testifies. So the tobacco lobby hires the very powerful lawyers, and they cross-examine him as an expert witness. So they come up with him, and they'll say, well, you know, Dr. Sadransky, do you agree that Statistical Science is a good peer-reviewed journal? I'll say, yes, you know, I agree that it's a good peer-reviewed journal. Well, don't you realize that in 1983 there was a study that was published in this journal which concluded that they could not demonstrate a scientific link between cancer of the bladder and smoking in aged men from 50 to 75, right? Don't you realize that's true? So to a regular jury, right, that's a very difficult thing to refute, because just because you can point to, you say, well, that magazine is not really like the journal Nature or the journal Science, you know, or these other journals. To a jury, that doesn't really mean anything. It's one peer-reviewed journal, it's another peer-reviewed journal. It just looks like a matter of opinion. So what did he do? What he said is the following. He says, look, how do you make a baseball? He says, the way you make a baseball is you start with a cork in the middle, and you start wrapping twine around it. And you wrap more twine around, and you've got millions of pieces of twine, and then you start putting over these raw hides on top, and then you start sewing it, right? Now, at any point, if someone asks you what it is that you're making, so it begins to look more and more like a baseball, right? And pretty soon, when you've got enough twine around it, and you've got enough rawhide on, you're starting to stitch it together, if you ask somebody what you're looking, it looks like a baseball. Right? It says the evidence against smoking is like that, right? For smoking causing cancer is like that. There are zillions of peer-reviewed studies, and each one of them is another piece of twine in the baseball. If you take one of those pieces of twine and you pull it out, do you say that we don't have a baseball anymore? Or do you say we have a baseball without a piece of twine? Right? We have a baseball with one piece of twine out. Right? That's what it is. That's what like asking one question on a scientific paradigm is like. Right? It doesn't destroy the paradigm. How then do you destroy a scientific paradigm? What Thomas Kuhn argues in the history of science is he actually goes through scientific revolutions. He calls it The Structure of Scientific Revolutions is the name of the book. And what he shows is that a scientific revolution takes place not when one question exists, and not even when many questions exist on a paradigm, But when another plausible paradigm comes out there, and then you have competing paradigms, you have one possible way of explaining things, and then you have another possible way of explaining things. He argues that until you have another possible way of explaining something, you'll never abandon your old one, no matter how bad it is. You need another possible way of making anything make sense. And slowly, when the second possible way seems to be more internally consistent, seems to explain things better than the old paradigm, slowly over time, people will make that jump. What God was trying to do was to create, so to speak, a scientific revolution in people's perceptions of Creator, and he had to do it in several different ways. It wasn't just enough to do it one thing. You had to create a paradigm which, in toto, made it seem simply implausible that the world makes sense with a whole polytheistic notion of God, and the competing paradigm of Creator seem attractive for a whole bunch of reasons. One of those whole bunch of reasons, or 10 of those reasons, were the 10 plagues. But there are more reasons than just that, right? There were other things that he needs to do. First of all, look at the nation that is chosen, right? The nation that history or that fate would have it would be the recipient of these plagues that was enslaving the Jews. It is the most polytheistic nation at the time. It is the greatest world power at the time, the sovereign of which thinks that he is himself a god in this pantheon of gods. What greater historical demonstration could you possibly have of the truth of monotheism than if you could get the president of the greatest world power of any polytheistic nation at the time to realize that his whole paradigm is wrong and to agree with you that you are the creator? If Pharaoh would say those words, you know what? I'm completely wrong. I am not a god like I thought. There's no pantheon of gods. There is one creator and you've proven it to me. If Pharaoh would only utter those words, it would all be over, and that would be the greatest demonstration of the truth of monotheism. I believe that that's what God was after in the Exodus. And that's why Pharaoh's will was so important in the Exodus. That's why God was not willing to take the Jews out without Pharaoh saying yes. What God was bargaining for, what God was gambling for, was he was gambling on things being so convincing that Pharaoh would come to a change of mind about his theological system, and despite all of the personal interest that he has invested in believing that he is a god, renounce that and agree that God is in fact the creator. That is why, ultimately, and now we come to the issue of Pharaoh's free will, right? Now, that is why it becomes so problematic to understand why God would harden Pharaoh's heart. What I want to suggest to you is that it was of prime importance that Pharaoh truly make a free will choice about whether or not there is a God in the universe. How is it that he's going to make that free will choice? His free will needs to be preserved at all costs. There is a problem. What is the problem? The problem is the following. Let's say that you are trying to get this sovereign, this president of Egypt, to agree that there is a creator. And you're trying to have 10 plagues to do it. Right? What is the problem? The problem is, what happens if in plague number 2 or plague number 3, what?
He realizes it's him, and he's lost all the impact.
No, let's say if he really realizes it would be right, but what would be the greatest disaster? Let's say
he doesn't buy it at the end.
No, okay, let's say he doesn't buy it at the end. Or let's say he doesn't even buy it at the beginning, but he lets them go anyway because why? Because he doesn't want the inconvenience. Let's say things get too tough. I mean, you've got a GNP to worry about here, right? Your economy's going to pot. Right? You just, at a certain point, you just think it's not worth holding on to these people anymore. So you let them go, not out of any great theological conviction, but who needs these guys anyway? So what God says is, no, ani achazek et libo. What does achazek et libo mean? We talked before about the difference between kibud alev and strengthening of heart. The strengthening of heart is to give one courage, right? To give one courage to do what? To pursue his vision, right? What did God do? God says that, you know what I'm going to do? I am going to enhance Pharaoh's free will. How am I going to enhance Pharaoh's free will? I'm going to say that I'm always going to give him the opportunity to make a theological choice. The one thing I will not give him a chance to do is to make a non-moral decision, an amoral decision, to simply let the Jews go without resolving the theological issue. Pharaoh has a theological agenda that is close to his heart. He wants to maintain his vision of himself as a god and a polytheistic pantheon of gods. We are in a battle over that vision. I am ultimately going to give Pharaoh full free will in that battle to make whatever choice he needs to make because he thinks it's the right choice. The moment Pharaoh says, I'm letting the Jews go because God is the creator, that's fine, right? And if Pharaoh wants to not let the Jews go because he doesn't think I'm the creator, that's fine too. But if he's going to let the Jews go because he just gives up the heart to continue the battle, I'll give him the courage to continue the battle. In other words, I'll lend the general of the opposing army courage to continue the fight. That's what any general needs. To begin a fight, a general needs courage, which is to steel himself against losses in pursuit of his vision. As long as Pharaoh has the vision, I'll give him the strength to pursue that vision. In a sense, that is actually an intensification of Pharaoh's ability to choose freely. There's going to be a free-willed moral choice going on here. What the choice is up to Pharaoh. Now, fascinatingly, this allows, and with this I'll close, for tonight at least, this allows for the possibility of Pharaoh refusing to see it. The problem with this gamble is that if it's really true that Pharaoh has the free will to choose to see that whether there's God here or not, then and that God can't mess with that, then that opens the possibility of what Searle suggests, which is that maybe it won't happen. Maybe Pharaoh will just be obstinate, will not just be stubborn, and he won't see it. Right? What will happen then? It is impossible, it is inconceivable that God would allow his plan for the universe to ultimately depend upon one man's choice, whether Pharaoh decides to accept it or not. There has to be a backup plan. Right? I suggest that God does have a backup plan, but I'm not going to tell you what it is tonight. The question is, what is God's backup plan in case this fails? Right? How is this going to work? What is the backup plan? How is he going to make this all come through if Pharaoh doesn't want... He's going to allow it to work through Pharaoh, but if it doesn't happen, how is it going to work? And I ask you to look objectively at the text and to tell me whether God's first plan really worked out or whether, in fact, God needed to resort to the backup plan. Right? Did Pharaoh agree or did Pharaoh not agree? And by the way, the answer to that is not so clear. Right, as you look through the text. So I invite you to look through the text and ask which plan of God succeeded, the original plan that Pharaoh would recognize it, or the backup plan, right? Prove why it's so, and if it was the backup plan, then what was the backup plan? Okay? That was question number one. What I'd also like you to do is to trace through, and I asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you this again because this is absolutely crucial and central. With all the information you have now, read through again the 10 plagues and Pharaoh's response to them, and read all of Pharaoh's responses where he makes his heart strong and courageous, and those responses where he stiffens his heart and makes his heart hard. You'll see that there's a very fascinating story that weaves it through. There's a battlefield being played out in Pharaoh's heart, right? And the Torah communicates keen psychological insight about what's going on in Pharaoh by its expression of whether Pharaoh is strengthening his heart, or whether he is hardening his heart, or God is strengthening Pharaoh's heart, or God is hardening Pharaoh's heart, and what Pharaoh's responses to all these plagues are. Read through the plagues very carefully, and you'll find a fascinating story, and that is homework assignment number two. Homework assignment number three, and with this I will close, is to try to come back to another question which we asked, which was the issue of precision versus power. Right? We were able to show that in plague after plague, God was interested in demonstrating precision more than power, in showing that he could turn off the frogs tomorrow when Pharaoh says to turn them off, in showing that he could get only the animals of the Egyptians to die and not one animal of the Jews to die. And Pharaoh bought it, and in both cases, bought the bait and was looking for precision over power. In the 10th plague, God had to Moses had to insulate himself and say, it's about midnight, because if Pharaoh mistook it and thought he was off, then there would have been no precision. Why is precision so important over power itself? How does that fit into the whole realm? And once it is that you answer that, it'll help you for question number two also, which is that as you read through the plagues and you look at Pharaoh's response in terms of a hardening heart, or stiffening his heart, or strengthening his heart, look and see how much precision was demonstrated by the plague and how that correlates with what's going on with Pharaoh's heart. Okay? And you'll be able to see that too. So there's a lot more to be done. We've also got to talk about the whole Bechor issue, which we started in week number one. So there really is a lot more to be done. I was a little bit too optimistic about getting it done tonight. So I'm going to ask your indulgence to create an epilogue. for those of you who would just want to call it quits here, you at least have some fun homework to think about and some good questions to ask on the Seder, and hopefully some ways of beginning to see some outlines to a deeper level of the story that you can then pull together by bouncing off these questions Seder night. Or if you want to come to an epilogue presentation, I will actually tie together these loose ends then. So for the meantime, good night, and I look forward to seeing all of you, or at least most of you, when we tie this all together. This concludes tape 4 of the series Exodus from Egypt, The Hidden Agenda. The series has continued at this point on tape 5.